The title of tonight's session is, forum is Mercy or Murder? Has the patient suffered enough? I want to first introduce our resource people here, and then they'll say a little bit of, I want to say a little bit about forums at Holden. We have here on my left Maggie Fink, who is a registered nurse from South Dakota, who is currently serving the village as the registrar. And Maggie has worked 11 years in long-term care with many people facing the end of their lives. And we also have Robert Niedringhaus, who many of you attended his session earlier, an oncologist for 22 years from Duluth, Minnesota. And he will speak to the medical and his own perspective. And then we also have John Marty, a state senator for 11 years from Minnesota, who will offer comments from a legislative perspective. Before I give each of them a chance to speak and then open it up to all of you, I want to just say a few things about forums at Holden. My job is to make sure that we begin on time and end on time, so we'll give an official end to the conversation at 9:30 and then invite continued discussion if you want to hang around here or continue it tomorrow or whenever. And Holden, I think, tries to create a safe place to express our ideas and opinions on a topic. So we try to practice good manners in our conversation at forums, like taking turns and respecting each other's views and values. And hopefully we'll be able to have many voices enter into the conversation. And all of this, of course, in a spirit of love and grace. I like to think Holden is a place, like Bob said in his session, that we can honestly talk about some of the issues near and dear to us, that we can't do that in our homes and our churches and communities. And I also like to think that each of us brings our best thinking to the discussion, and no one voice is more important than another one. And together we can make each other very wise. We'll disagree, and if you hear something you disagree with here, that's okay. We don't have to come to a decision tonight. That's the wonderful thing about forums. We don't have to have a consensus. We only need to listen and struggle together as Christian people around this issue of how we die. And I want to remind people that we are all Holden here. There's no official position on any of the issues we talk about. And it's a wide community with many voices. So with that, I want to begin with Maggie.
My remarks in part are in response to the article that I read, No Magic Pill, and then also from my perspective working in long-term care the last 11 years. In the article, Ron Hamill was asked, is life-sustaining technology one of the practices which fosters a growing interest in assisted suicide? And he answers that by saying that it can be a serious problem that our medical technology enables people to be kept alive longer. But he says anyone who's on life support can come off at any moment. We don't need assisted suicide for that. In my 11 years in long-term care as a nurse and also as a director of nursing, I came to see the feeding tube as one of those technologies. It became, in truth, the life support for some people. And in the settings where I worked, those feeding tubes could not come off at any moment. I'm going to compare the two facilities in which I worked because the philosophies were very different. And over time, we learned some things, of course, too, in dealing with people who had feeding tubes. In the first skilled nursing home where I worked, the feeding tubes were used when people had the most severe swallowing impairments, often following strokes, in the late stages of multiple sclerosis, or when a traumatic brain injury had occurred and the person was either comatose or what we would call semi-comatose. And I came to see that families were asked to make just agonizing decisions, excruciating, when they were told that a loved one could no longer feed themselves or that they could no longer swallow nourishment of any kind on their own. But what I came to see also was that once that decision was made to allow the physician to insert the feeding tube, I never, in the first years of practice, saw a family decide finally that enough was enough, that this life support then could come off. I came to think about this issue, however, more humanely as I grew to put human faces on individuals and their families. As I grew to know their names, in small communities where I worked, you also grew to love those people and also to love the caretakers who worked with them in those two small nursing homes where I practiced. And so I really want to tell you about Clara. She was a woman who came to us before her 75th birthday. She had suffered a severe brain hemorrhage, which had left her totally mute, except for a rare groaning. She had lost all her hair, and her left arm and legs were flaccid, so that she couldn't support her body to stand, let alone barely to sit in a chair. But we used positioning devices of every kind to allow her to sit up in this support chair for about an hour and a half each day in the afternoon. It took three nursing assistants and a mechanical lift to accomplish that feat. She was about 5'10" tall, and we could get her, though, from the bed to the chair every day because one of our goals was that she wouldn't be bedfast. Clara's right arm and hand movement were intact, however, but she didn't really have control over those movements. And the right hand would often just go flying up over her head spastically. She had no control over her neck and head or tongue, and her tongue was almost in constant motion, as you'd see her when she was awake, appearing often swollen, and of course she drooled almost continually. The haunting picture that I have of her to this day is seeing her slumped down in that support chair as hard as we work to get her to sit. We tried, her head rolling from side to side, her tongue out and drooling, and her right hand would fly up in the air and knock off this turban that we tried to use because we tried to have some shred of dignity for her, some semblance of dignity. When Clara came to us from the hospital, she had a stomach tube which had been surgically sutured to her stomach wall because, as we learned, that she had a history already of being able to pull out the stomach tube with her good hand. And in fact, in the first 3 weeks of her stay in the nursing home, we returned her three times to the hospital to have the stomach tube re-surgically replaced. But after the third try, the physicians abandoned the idea of surgically placing the tube and replaced it with a tube that had an inflatable balloon, much like a Foley catheter, which we nurses then could replace. Along with this change, the decision was also made with the family and physicians' input and the staff that we would physically then restrain Clara's right hand to her bed when her feeding tube was running. And at this time, that was nearly continuously. At that time, we would run the feedings around the clock. That was the way we used to do things. But in spite of this procedure, Clara continued to be able to pull out the feeding tube at times when the staff would remove the wrist restraint, as we faithfully did also around the clock every 2 hours. Her overwhelming demeanor was one of great sadness. That's another thing I will always remember. The only actual dignified picture that I have of her was when she was sleeping peacefully at night. And the way I thought of her was a warm, very pale, bald woman, almost angelic at rest. But often at night, we would observe tears coming down her face, even though she wasn't able to talk to us. And on very rare occasions during the night, however, she would make eye contact with me, and she would smile. And I would always hug her and say, "Oh, Clara," it's a smile because it was rare, but she would do that endless times when we would turn her and wash her and take care of her. Over the 2 years that I cared for her, we developed a more humane protocol for those feedings. We ran the feedings only during the night hours so that then during the day she could be free from that wrist restraint and that feeding bag with its long tether, as I like to call it. However, that was a double bind for us, because even though we allowed her that freedom, she continuously then, of course, was able to pull the tube out, and it had to be replaced very regularly. I think, however, for me, the greatest sadness came, and one of the things that I was listening earlier, the greatest sadness for Clara was that she had an almost total withdrawal from her family. So she didn't have the support and encouragement of a family during her years of trial. I never really got to know her only daughter. It's maybe hard for you to believe, but in the 4 years that I worked with Clara, her daughter only visited once a year, and that would be on Mother's Day. She would come and spend about half an hour, and the one conversation that I did have with her, she said, I cannot bear to see my mother this way. I do, however, remember the one visit that I had with her son. His practice also was to come once a year and visit her. We had been waiting and wanting to visit. We planned regular care planning conferences with families throughout their care and throughout their stay. We would invite the family, as we always did, and he never came, but we decided about 2 years into this that it would be a wonderful thing if we could just have a conversation with the son to see how the family was feeling, if they felt any need to talk to the physician about Clara's continuing rejection of this, what we began to see as the life support system for her. Mm-hmm. So I happened to catch her son outside the door of her room one Sunday afternoon as he was leaving. And I thought, I was, however, new to the work, and I thought that I was being as tactful as I could. But I said to him, has the family ever thought about visiting with the doctor about the quality of life that their mother had with her feeding tube? I was totally unprepared for the reaction from Clara's son that Sunday afternoon, because in my mind I was being reasonable and respectful. But he lashed out at me and said, I won't let my mother starve. She fed me all my life and she never let me starve. Would you starve your own mother? And with that, he turned on his heel and was gone. As I said, that incident occurred quite a while ago, many years ago. Clara did live 4 years with that feeding tube. My regret was that I was not able to be an advocate for her as I would have liked to have been. In the time that has passed, I have learned that we can do better. The physicians that I came to work with in the last nursing home had a different mindset about feeding tubes. They tried to be realistic about the use, and actually, instead of ordering sophisticated swallowing studies and ordering feeding tubes for people, they had a different tactic in which they encouraged all the many attempts we made at feeding strategies, from the specialized diets we would use to using nutritional supplements and feeding syringes, and always with the mindset that we would force feed no one. And as I worked with nursing assistants over the years, I learned that you cannot actually force someone to eat. The human body, I wouldn't tolerate it among my staff, and it wouldn't happen. And I also, another thing that we learned was better treatment of depression. I think that that's another thing we missed with Clara. We could have done better with the treatment of her depression and other things too. But I think that the point I want to make is that it's a difficult decision when you work with a person like Clara. Actually, her son was her durable power of attorney for health care. So at some point she had made a rational decision to have him speak for her. And he made some kind of a decision. To us, it seemed clear what her decision was, but to him, it was something that he absolutely couldn't face. The one comment then that Ron Hamel also made in his article that I took issue with a little bit was when he said that the dying need to surrender so that people can respond to their needs. I felt that Clara, in her life, never did surrender to that feeding tube, but she had no power and not even a voice to stop it.
Thank you. Bob?
I don't know exactly what I should kind of reiterate about what I talked about before, except that I think from the physician standpoint, I think that's bringing this a little bit to a crux are some of the recent court decisions. There's in 1994, the state of Oregon voters approved physicians having the right to give people lethal doses of medications for assisted suicide if they wanted. And although that hasn't been implemented yet, I think it's being contested. They're the only state in the union so far that's had that kind of law in the books. Subsequent to that, last year in March of '96, the state of Washington had a case, Compassion in Dying versus the state of Washington, where the court decided that you couldn't use the 14th Amendment to support the idea that you couldn't stop someone from taking their own life on the same basis that you couldn't stop someone from having an abortion. The same clause in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. One that's a little more compelling, however, is the one in New York from April of last year that has to do with the idea that most of the states have laws that allow people who are in assisted or on life support, assisted ventilation in particular, to, if they're competent and they have no hope of going off that and have no hope of recovery, they have the right to terminate that and to die. And it has a plug on the machine we pulled, and that's been part of most of our state laws, certainly in Minnesota it is. They extended that to say that the Equal Protection Clause, the 14th Amendment, to support the idea that even if you weren't on life support, if you were terminally ill, that you would be able to terminate your life willfully with assistance from a physician if you so choose, because just being on life support or not being on life support wasn't a determinant. In fact, was discriminating against those who weren't on life support. The extension of that is that anyone who's, even those who aren't terminally ill, may have the right to do that because our rights under the Constitution are based not on whether we're on life support or whether we're terminally ill, but whether we're U.S. citizens. And so the legal ramifications of this are hard for them to wrestle with. And so it's in front of the Supreme Court right now. So that's kind of what's happening. There's a lot in our press. If you watch, there's just something in the Minneapolis paper during my talk a couple hours ago. I think in our paper in Duluth, Minnesota, a ton of 90,000, we probably had one or two articles a month related to this in our papers. There's been a fair amount in the medical literature. Issues that are important, I think, are how do you define somebody who's terminal, and what are the reasons that people seek this? Many of the people who seek this are feeling that they don't want to be a personal care burden to their families, they don't want to be a financial burden, they don't want to be in pain, and from a physician standpoint, it's hard to sort out who's competent to make these decisions, who's depressed, who's delirious, who may have some dementia, how are the drugs affecting their decision making, that kind of thing. So for us, I think for medicine, organized medicine right now, organized nursing, associations that have to do with care of the elderly and geriatric associations and so forth in the United States don't look very favorable in this whole idea. May need to help them die more quickly, is the other side of the argument. So that there's gray zones here, but I think it's safe to say that from a physician standpoint, we're not real nuts about this idea, but we're not sure what's going to happen and what role we're going to be asked to play.
Thank you.
I was asked to comment some on the politics and the government role in this, and I think as Bob pointed out, Jackie, at the beginning of this, nobody allows physician-assisted suicide other than Oregon, where it's not allowed yet. And the whole difficulty of dealing with issues like this is that government is not the best place to make medical decisions. When I hear any one of these complex stories with a lot of gray areas, we can't write laws to say, in Clara's case, we should do this, and in somebody else's case, we should do that. The law goes across the board everywhere. So when you have to give guidance, and one of the physicians here tonight said, at some point, governments are going to, or the public is going to have to say, here's what we expect from the medical community, here's how we deal with it. But government does not deal with these issues well. And I'll also suggest that in looking at the future, the states with voter initiatives are the most likely ones to allow it, because I have not seen the polls, but I think Bob referred in his talk to the fact that a majority does support physician-assisted suicide, at least in some of the polls. But legislatures and U.S. Congress and so on tend to go by who's vocal and who's not. And the people who tend to be most vocal on this issue are those who are most opposed to it. When I look at what issues are likely to come up on this issue in the future, as one who doesn't want government to be intruding too heavily in this doctor-patient, medical provider and recipient of medical care type of relationship, I think the one thing where there's a very clear public role is to make sure that we're not having people who are going ahead and doing, killing people. People who are, oh yeah, I thought they wanted it. This article that Jackie just handed me 5 minutes before the beginning mentioned how in the Netherlands, where I thought it was legal, it just says it's been condoned for 20 years, that there are some opponents have argued that some of the physicians doing it are giving lethal doses of medication or injections or whatever to people where it's not clear that they asked for it or wanted it. Is that scare tactics by opponents or is it reality? Well, I guess I think when the medical providers say they're very uneasy about being put in a position where they may be making decisions on this, even at the request of a patient, I think we ought to recognize that that is a great, great fear, I think, of all of us, that we don't want them to have to be put in that position. They don't want to be put in that position. And that's an issue we ought to address. But where can states step in and make sure? Well, I think both in terms of both of the previous two speakers, there are lots of times when there's nothing done as an alternative. Is there a good opportunity for pain relief medication available? Are there hospice programs available? And I really didn't know the situation in Minnesota. I know of a number of hospices that have opened up recently, and you've said that there are sufficient ones for people now. I'm not sure, but those are the areas where the public can take a proactive role to make it less frequent and less difficult of decision. There are other areas, I guess I like to think of how can we prevent the worst, most painful decision to have to be made. And certainly in the areas of advanced directives, living will types of things, or durable power of attorney, though as Maggie pointed out, even durable power of attorney, her son who had been given that power was doing something that seems to me, from what you're saying, was pretty clearly directly opposed to what she was asking for and was struggling hard to express her wishes for. So it's not a perfect solution, but most of the time we don't even talk about this. We spent 5-6 years trying to pass living will legislation in Minnesota because a small group of people said, this is the first step towards probably physician-assisted suicide, among other things. But the idea of letting people have some choices in not prolonging their life support when they don't want it, letting them make decisions, that's the healthiest thing. I think we as Christians want to have people talk about these and not be so scared of death that we wait until it's too late. So given the track record of government in dealing with these issues, I guess I'll ratify what one of the two physicians here said tonight about doesn't want government intervening too much, but on the other hand, our society has to give doctors guidelines. Because when Bob said in his talk earlier about the 50-fold increase in morphine for a patient, I see that as a little bit different than physician-assisted suicide, as does Bob, as does the patient. Presumably, your goal there is to relieve pain, even though it may have the impact of speeding up death. And I want to make sure that we're not prosecuting people, that our laws are clear enough that a physician who is doing their best to care for the patient, nurse, some other care provider who is doing their job properly and trying to do the humane thing to people and is not trying to kill somebody, is not prosecuted for using their best judgment. But boy, if you want to talk about shades of gray, there are plenty of them there.
Okay, thank you. Want to open it up for responses or stories or comments or additional issues that we didn't touch on?
I have a question, and I don't know who directed it, probably maybe Bob. If a patient wants to have assisted suicide, does it take the concession of the family to do this, or can it be just the patient, between the patient and the doctor?
They can't do it at all right now. It's against the law. It's against the law right now. So
how about it has always been against the law, right? It's always been against the law.
But people do it all the time, though, right?
Pardon me?
People do it all the time, although it's against the law.
They get physicians to help them do it. People, that's one of the issues here. Why do you need to have physicians help you? I've got people at home who we were talking during my talk that there are people who have all kinds of morphine on hand. We allow within reasonable range of self-dosing of morphine and narcotics for pain control. If they want to take 2 weeks worth, it's not unusual for them to have that much on hand to do it themselves or to shut the garage door and leave the car running. Suicide on your own has always been a kind of a bad thing. As I mentioned in my talk, it's been beginning in England and into our country. It's been something that suicide has been thought not to be a good thing. Your life has been felt to be not only yours but belongs to the community. It's life that was given to you by God. It's not yours to take. It's been the thinking over the centuries. That may be changing, and whether we live in a country where people really feel that mentally competent people should be able to have the right to decide when and how they're going to die is an issue that I think our society is going to be facing.
I ask this question because I have been dealing with this for the last 3 or 4 years. I had a friend, by the way, she was from Bellingham, Washington, where I live, and she and her husband had been here at Holden, and this is when she had her first stroke was when she was up here, and after that it was just a general decline where she had gangrene and lost a leg, and she was in a nursing home. And I picked up this friendship picked up once when she was already in the hospital in the nursing home. And her final one leg had been amputated and the other one had to be amputated. And she had left the nursing home. Obviously, she was in the hospital. I'm not real clear on this because the family didn't come forth with any information. I had just seen her the day before, and suddenly I get a telephone call the next morning that she's dead. And the doctor had given her self-morphine, and he said that she could never undergo another leg amputation, and she wouldn't move through if she didn't have, she wasn't strong enough. And I never really understood this, that she just simply took enough, and I think she committed suicide. That's the way it appears to me. And the question that I had, of course, when her son called, and the first thing I did was blurt out, you know, well, how did all this happen? No one claimed ownership to this within the family. They wouldn't talk about it. No one talked about it at the funeral.
Do you think she took this in the nursing home?
No, it was some. If she was out of the nursing home, and I think she was not at home. She didn't have a family home anymore. Her husband was already in another nursing home. No, she didn't go home. I think that she must have been in the hospital. I'm not really sure.
Because on a morphine self-indose in the hospital, you cannot.
You cannot. You cannot commit suicide with that.
Well, not the.
Well,
I'm aware.
At any rate, I was always confused about the death. The family would never discuss it with me, and so I have been. But what I have been left with is just a terrible pain. I can't put closure to this. This is another issue of how does it affect a family when a person decides to commit suicide. And I've had plenty of them in my family. My mother committed suicide. My sister committed suicide. I come from an alcoholic background and very dysfunctional family, and I've been through so many suicides. And the other ones I have managed to put closure to, but this one I cannot put closure to because I guess I just don't understand why it happened, how it happened, and there's just, it's too open-ended. I don't know. And I was with her. I mean, I worked with her, and I just can't imagine. In the other cases of suicide in my family, I didn't have any contact with these people. I mean, they chose to do this. My sister shot herself in the head. You know, and I wasn't even around. I had no contact with her. I didn't feel responsible for this. It was terrible pain, but I didn't feel responsible. But this case, I did. And this is really hard. It's hard on people who are part of family and friends when this kind of thing happens. And that's getting off the issue of the technicalities of it. There's a human issue of it.
Yeah, I think you raised some important issues, though, Marion, about the effect on other people around and the sense of community that's a part of the discussion. Other comments?
I have a very hard time in justifying the fact that in our society now, our senior citizens who are getting older and who have a terminal illness and sometimes have lost quality of life to the place they're almost vegetables are taking money for their maintenance from Medicare or families or whoever's giving it, whereas we have hundreds of children who are not getting adequate care. And this seems to me an unbalanced situation. And I have a very hard time justifying that when I see nursing home people who are just vegetables, just living day after day, and a lot of them would prefer to just say goodbye.
That's a tough one.
Tough one. Big problem. It's going to get worse. I mean, as an aging population here.
Now, no wonder Medicare is going to go broke and none of us have the care that we have if we keep this kind of thing up.
The economics of it all is... Doris?
Yeah, I started in medicine before. We had the gastric tubes, NG tubes down, feeding tubes as we're calling them. And I really wonder how much service we have given to people by putting this down. Because I've been in long-term care now since 73. And I see so many people laying there with no quality of life. And, you know, horrendous bed sores. We do not have the staff to take care of somebody or the money. And we're keeping them alive. And we're now looking at some of the nursing homes in, I happen to live in Minneapolis, where we've got one nursing home who's going, is not having any chemical or physical restraints to people. Mm. And it's fantastic to see that. if they're going to be pulling out a feeding tube, then, you know, the families have to come to terms. And that patient may be taken out of that nursing home because they're saying that family does, that patient does not want that feeding tube in. We're not going to restrain that hand. We're not going to give her Haldol. We're not, you know, they get the family together. And between the nursing staff, between the social workers, the doctors, and they sit down with the family. And it's been, I see this one nursing home really making some great strides. And instead of tying them into the beds at night, they put the mattress on. They're making, their maintenance man has got a thing on, and the mattress is down, off. So we're not tying people into bed at night. They can get up. They're not going to fall out of bed. And it's really great when you see that. And some of the really good Alzheimer's units have no restraints, no chemical and physical restraints. Mm-hmm. And I think we've got to get away from that too, and then really assess those feeding tubes. What are we doing to these people?
One of the things we have to look at, I mean, one of the problems, as you indicated, is that last summer I got a chance to spend some time in Africa. I visited a student who lived with us for a few years, and they don't have this problem there. People, for one thing, people don't live quite as long, but there are some people that do. And the ones who do don't go to nursing homes. They're taken care of by their families. There's no problem with the government having to cover a nursing home coverage. They're not taking any money away from children because these people are just moving with their extended family, just like we used to do 60 or 70 years ago. And that's not happening anymore. We don't have very many people. I don't have very many patients who are taken care of by their kids anymore. Their kids will try to help, but half the time they're both working. They're trying to make ends meet. They've got problems with their kids. It's not easy in our society, but we've got kind of a self-made problem here that we're not taking care of each other. We may see today, but we're going to have to.
Unfortunately, historically, we really never have taken the best care of our elders. Actually, we had poor farms way back, and actually, when the mental hospitals were so full in this country back in the 1960s, what we're finding now is that many of those were elderly people with their dementias and even depression and serious mental illnesses. So our country has never really come to grips with that really well, and now, as you say, who takes care of their people? No, families aren't able to do that and don't do that well.
There was
a hand over here. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I'm younger. I don't really have to deal with a lot of death, but I was talking to my mom, and she was saying that really she's afraid of something like this being, you know, put into law, because we live in Oregon, and because... Sorry. I think against Oregon. But it's just that because of the way she said that she hoped that I would be the one who would have to take care of her, because my brother, specifically the younger one, not the one that's married to first.
I was just going to say, wait a minute.
His attitude is, if you're old, whether you're dying or not, if you're old and you're costing me money, out the door. And she's like, you know, I'm afraid that if I ever get sick or if I need some care, that he's just going to go. And I know that sounds crazy, but I see it a lot in people my age, people older than me, with that attitude. And a lot of people like that are my teachers at school. And so they're going to be teaching my children things like that. Well, not my children, other people. But, you know, that's our next generation. Yeah. And if we have laws that allow that, they're going to be, you know, well, you know, you may not actually be dying, but I'm tired of you, so. I mean, that sounds terrible. But just attitudes like that, and I don't know, it scares me too, because I'm going to be able to see it.
Let me suggest that politically, that's not likely to happen where we have laws that give people the power to say we're going to dump you out the door. Politically, that's not where the pressure would be. There are certainly some people who feel that way, but I think one of the advances in death and dying issues nationally, is the acceptance of living will types of things where you have the power to determine what's going to happen to your future. And when you said, well, I'm young and I don't have to worry about this, well, mm-hmm. I know I was a strong pusher for living will legislation, and I kind of, Connie and I talked, we got the forms right away when they were available, and we were going to fill them out, but you know, it's kind of a hassle, and it was only when I had to go in for surgery, we better fill these things out. But it's too often people wait too long, so I was going to say this discussion is healthy, and people your age, people of every age, ought to be discussing this. But I don't think a realistic fear is that you're going to have children making a decision, you're too old and you're expensive, forget it. I hope not that children feel that way, but if they do, the person, the recipient of the care is the one who chooses, who gives them, the who makes the decisions, or they can make it in advance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some of the articles you read will talk about the fact that one of the problems for ours, if you see what's happened in Holland or Netherlands compared to here, is one of the problems with us is that we've already kind of de facto decided not to take good care of everybody. I mean, there's a large segment of our society that we are bothering to take good care of medically. And if you've already made that sort of decision, then to add to that makes the ability, and I mean the ability for certain people to maybe there to be a differential in how soon a physician would see that certain, if the physician becomes part of a death process, we've already made priorities between people. And I know people have said, well, it's easier in a homogeneous society where everyone has equal access to health care and where there isn't overwhelming concerns about the cost, to say, well, then maybe there aren't the all these extraneous issues that come into it if you say, well, in this quite controlled society, we can see patients and doctors working together without duress to make decisions about when. But it's real interesting to me that the reasons that people have said they think maybe they would like to be assisted to die have more to do with the cost and the inconvenience that they are to others. That's a frightening thought, to think that as older people we may come to the point that we feel, well, maybe it'd be better if we get out of the way of our children. That says something about our
healthcare
system.
Mm-hmm. That sort of piggybacks on what this woman said earlier too about how much we spend on dying when there are so many people without basic healthcare. And one more thing, since Oregon came up a few minutes ago, I think when society makes decisions to ration care, and we do ration care in this country, but not consciously, we just don't fund it for lots of people. When Oregon made a decision that they were going to give certain ration care, and we were going to determine certain procedures were experimental and they would not be covered, I think society, if we're going to ration care, we might as well do it in a logical way. But the thing that scares me about Oregon's situation was they didn't make a statewide decision. They decided low-income people and medical assistance, we're going to make these things experimental. And then it's easy for public officials and others to say, well, we'll make that one's experimental. If you have that, you're out of luck, you die. If legislators and everybody is included in the pool, you're likely to have a lot different lines that you draw. And that may be, I think that taps into the point that two of you have made about the rationing of care, that we don't provide care for everyone.
I see it as a rich and poor issue in our state because the Medicaid, which is our state assistance, is always increasing. The nursing home that I worked in at the end was still about one-third private pay. Two-thirds were on Medicaid, and I don't know what it's like in other states, but it's continuing to grow. And an interesting thing that was happening was that the Beverly Company, which is the largest of nursing homes in this country, however, in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, has now opened a magnificent nursing home with rooms that they call suites, and those are totally private pay wings of their nursing home. So that there are distinctions being made. Then you go down to Texas and visit a nursing home that's totally 100% Medicaid. And there are distinctions, definite distinctions between rich and poor.
Well, I was going to kind of ask a question that might not be yet answered. I talked to Jackie yesterday, and I wasn't going to do this, but I feel that I should speak. I am a dying person. I have cancer throughout my body. My doctor says I'm the healthiest looking dying person that he has, but a lot of it does have to do with my attitude. 9 months ago, I had my large intestine and my colon removed. 1985, I had a double mastectomy, and just in May, I had to have a knee replacement because the cancer had got into my knee. To me, dying is not a bad option because I'm a Christian. I can't imagine, I do imagine because I go out and I speak to people that are, to hospice groups and to people that are dying and are not dealing with it very well. I happen to have my entire funeral planned. I've spoken, it's a common conversation in my family. I have 6 children, fortunately that they are mostly all raised. My youngest will be going into college. Because of this disease, I lost my husband. He decided that he didn't want to be married to a disabled person. So I've had a lot of losses, not only because of my health, but I've also had losses in my family. I'm very appreciative of hospice. I've been through hospice. I've been through chemotherapy 5 times. I've lost my hair 5 times. I've been laying on deathbed. I've actually died. I had cardiac arrest. I had to be brought back to life. And as a patient, I would just like to say that hospice is a very, very important part of someone who has an incurable disease. I feel that I know that you spoke earlier about the opportunities to go and get as much people that are dying really reach out to try anything that there is. I've gone that route. I've gone the route of thinking about suicide, that how do I deal with this with my family? Since I'm not that old, I don't consider myself that old, of finances. But I'm thankful, number one, that I have a strong faith in the Lord, and my attitude and prayers have helped me. You mentioned that also earlier, that you had some people talk about somehow some patients do better if they have a lot of people praying for them. I just want to speak up as someone that has been going through this for the last 3 years, that there is quality life, even though you're experiencing yourself dying. There is quality life if you choose to have it. And a lot of it has to do with your attitude and your feelings. And I appreciate senators who pass laws that allow funding for hospice organizations. I appreciate doctors that care about pain of the patient. Pain's a big issue. It's not fun to be laying in bed. You can't lift your head up because you've had so much chemotherapy and you want to die. And so a pain issue is very, very important. And so I just wanted to speak as someone who, I say I am a dying person because I do have incurable disease, and there is not a, I'm going to die. It's a lot sooner than I anticipated. But so I just felt that I should share that.
Thank you.
I would comment on her statements here that she has accepted death as a part of life. And I think in our society as a whole, and even those of us who are Christians, have not accepted death as a part of life. We kind of feel we have to go on forever and ever. And in our society, families of older people and others, we need to accept death. I appreciate your attitude.
Some days it's not easy.
You just talked about accepting death. I think we need to distinguish between death and dying. I am not afraid of death, but dying I have a few qualms about. and I have no control over, but as to how. And I think this is what the whole concept of assisted suicide is dealing with, not death itself, but the dying process. And you have seen patients who are in extreme pain that even the best medication isn't able to help. Or if you've seen them watching their resources drain away, you can understand the mental anguish that they're in and why they want to get the damn thing over with. And so there are two sides to this coin. I don't know how I feel about assisted suicide. I'm quite ambivalent because I can see the rationale. At the same time, it's wrong to take a life. So it does bear a lot of discussion. But remember, it's dying. It's the question, not death as much.
Others, especially,
I had a situation with my mom. She was in the state of Pennsylvania and had a couple of terminal things going on, and there was a set of gerontologists, three, and the one, at one point she got pneumonia and asked, she had a living will, okay, and that was established when she was rational, and it was, she got this pneumonia. And the one doctor said, okay, we won't treat it because we know if we do that, you know, then she's just going to keep, she'll get better and then continue to suffer with what she has. And our family, you know, had to kind of decide whether that was, you know, whatever to do. And so we came to that decision to leave that, the antibiotics off. And then the partner came in and said, who made this decision? And we can't have her on our books as having died from hospital-acquired pneumonia. And so gave her lives. Then she got placed in a nursing home, and you know, still she has this living will. And they didn't feed her, which she probably didn't want to eat. Then they gave her insulin. She took too. They gave her too much, and I guess you know the combination. She went into like a coma. So on the way back to the hospital, in the ambulance, they can resuscitate you. Now that's my question is like, how can they do that if you have a living will that they worked on her and resuscitated her so that by the time she got to the hospital, she was put on life support. Mm-hmm. And what they told us was that like, well, you have to have that like reinstated every time you get to a hospital.
Well, that's a communication error.
Does that make sense? Does an ambulance have to revive somebody?
No.
Yeah. Yeah. It's different state to state.
If it's a 911
call, because you overrun your living will.
You can have a situation where you can call an ambulance and they can come to your home. Mm-hmm. And if there's somebody there who can say, no, we don't want resuscitation, we want intubation. You can, the ambulance drivers can do everything other than that.
That's calling the ambulance. That's not calling the
ambulance. I don't know what the state.
Right.
I think it varies from state.
If the nursing home called it and they knew that she had a living will,
She was transferred from the hospital to the nursing home.
Yeah.
The fact that she was not to be resuscitated is part of her diagnosis list. And if she was then transferred from the nursing home back to the hospital, there's a transfer sheet that goes along with all the medications or diagnoses, all the critical things like what kind of diet is she resuscitated. Mm-hmm. There's a checkoff we have a check option. Are they assessed? Do they want to be assessed or don't they? It's right on the front sheet. Mm-hmm. That doesn't have to be redone every time somebody takes an ambulance ride. Mm-hmm.
But is it possible that in Pennsylvania it does have to be redone?
I kind of doubt that, but this sounds more like a kid. You know, it sounds like she got into problems with communication problems.
Well, it was an issue in this article also for this woman. I don't know what state.
Was it a mistake or was it?
Well, she talked about the fact that they had no resuscitation and the EMTs said they were obligated to do it in that. But I don't know if this was in Minnesota or what state it actually occurred in.
It was New York.
It was in Minnesota. She was from Minnesota.
Even in the hospital, though, she would have the right to refuse treatment. And if it was documented that the family had refused, and that she had, I think even back that far, that was unfortunate.
These living wills aren't even legal documents. Mm-hmm. People can change those anytime they want. Right. That's one of the problems with them, actually, is that people can make up their minds 5 years ago what they want, and then when the chips are down, they have the right to change those. You don't have to go into any kind of legal maneuver to change those anytime you want. They're not written in stone, they're not even a legal document. They're your wishes.
No, but the durable power of attorney is.
but they guide care. But your advocate or you, or any family member can revoke that anytime they want. Verbally can revoke that.
Yeah.
What I have read many times is having the advanced medical directives, it's good. We still really need 1, 2, 3 really strong advocates to make sure that nursing homes, hospitals, and so forth follow those. It's just way more common than we originally thought that advanced medical directives are just kind of
sometimes
ignored.
I think one of the things that happens, surprisingly enough, is that oftentimes there's a good relationship and understanding actually between the patient and the physician. If you've taken care of somebody for 10, 20 years, you can have a relationship. The conflicts I have or somebody I'm taking care of who has something bad happen to them, and a non-custodial child come flying in from Timbuktu and have a different idea about what ought to be done. That's when I really appreciate healthcare declarations. Mm-hmm. I can say, listen, I've talked to your mom repeatedly about this. This is what she wants. If she gets pneumonia, she doesn't want to be treated. She doesn't want to feed it to. And I'll tell you something else, we got right here in black and white. And I don't care what you say. Your mom's can override you in this room. And that's the problem we get into. There's very seldom a conflict, even though we have some horror cases like this, very seldom times when physicians are going to cram something down somebody's throat against their will. And that just doesn't happen. Families don't stand for it, the patients know they don't have to stand for it. We get overridden by other family members. Whether it's conflicts in families, dysfunctional families, mm-hmm. people with guilt about their parents, mm-hmm. maybe they weren't paying enough attention to their mom, and hadn't written to her for 6 months, never called her, or mad at her. Now something bad's happened to her, and the way they're going to appease themselves is to come back and make everybody miserable.
Keeping her
alive. I'm not sure how much they love her. But that happens also.
We call that the daughter from California.
I'm aware of the time, so I want to make sure there's other opportunities to speak for people who really want to do that or are hesitant.
Well, I guess I have something to say. I think I was in fifth grade or sometime in junior high school, and I read about Native Americans, and a lot of times they would travel from one place to another. And the family would set up their teepees or whatever, and the older people would arrive late. But sometimes the family would have to go slow because they were waiting for them. And when the grandmother and grandfather wanted to die, they would just walk up a hill and just sit there maybe 2 days or 3 days, and decide to die. And I remember thinking back then, I think that's what I would like to do. It just sounded really pleasant, and I still think that.
It isn't pleasant, though. I mean, when you starve yourself and you're thirsty and you have anything to drink, it's like Christ on the cross. It's really a terrible way to die. I'm not saying it's wrong, but it isn't easy.
I think you raise a good point, though, about the thinking about your own dying process and even beginning to talk about it with others. I know the faith perspective was raised by a few people, and I'm wondering if people are having conversations like this in their home congregations and their faith communities or wherever.
Before I left, my pastor called, wished me well, and I said, he said, well, I hope your health is good there. And I said, well, if not, you know what to do with me. Because he knows exactly. Mm-hmm. And he laughed, and I laughed too. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, given the fact that everyone in this room is going to die someday,
you
faced it. You're facing it very well. Yeah. Yeah. It's healthy for us all to remember. Mm-hmm.
It's not easy, but it can be done.
Other comments? Yeah, Doris.
I have a mother that will be 90 years old, and she has probably given me the best gift that she could have ever given a daughter. Is she has her funeral planned. Mm-hmm. She has sat down and told my sister and I have a brother, just what she wants done. She has lived a good life. She says, I'm a Christian. I am not afraid to die. And she has given us that gift. And I think so often families need to sit down and talk, because death is part of living, and we're all going to die. And I also have a son-in-law who is here with us, who left today, who has muscular dystrophy. John is not going to be with us forever, and we know that. The only thing we can do is love him every day we have him, and he's living every day of his life. He's not planning for tomorrow. There may not be one, but he's given us a gift too. Because we live each day that we can, because we don't know what tomorrow's gonna give. Mm-hmm. And we have sat down and had some very good conversations. And I think we have to be not afraid of death and what we have to do, but we need to sit down with our families. We have sat down with our daughters. They know what Gary and I want, and I think we have to do that. I don't plan on dying at my age, but I may. And my daughters know. Mm-hmm. And they have been made durable power of attorney for us.
Mm-hmm. Others? Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that the conversation has run over the past few years, and I think we're all pretty comfortable now with the passive euthanasia, the concepts. And it'll be fascinating to see if, as the next decade comes along, if the active euthanasia becomes more of an acceptable process in our society. I despair that, I think the church has to be in the front of this kind of discussion. And it's hard, I think, as all of us within a community, when you know individuals where these decisions may mean a great deal to them as individuals, it's hard to stand up and make decisions and make pronouncements that'll apply to an entire community as diverse as we are outside of a place like this. And I hope that the church maintains an active role in making these kinds of decisions in societal kind of direction.
Mm-hmm.
The president of our congregation is dying of cancer. Mm-hmm. He's a young man, he's in his 30s. He's lost a lot of weight. I don't think he's going to live another 6 months, but he comes from the treatment center back when he's strong enough to the congregation. And of course, the congregation has been praying in mass for him and praying for his health. I mean, that's a very positive thing. But I was talking to the pastor and I said, I think there's a point that we have to start praying for. I mean, we're praying for his health, but also we need to look at the fact of losing him. We're going to lose him, just like we lose any member of the family, and we have to prepare for that loss. And our pastor's at a loss, literally. He does not know what to do. And when that death occurs, because of the gentleman is very public, because he's our president, it's going to hit that congregation right between the eyes. And we're all going to go into guilt. We're going to go into all the seven steps of mourning, and then we're going to start all over again.
Why?
And it's going to be really, really, I mean, you know, oh, I don't know. I dread it. I dread it.
Why would we go into guilt? If you have guilt, you need to go and talk to that person because right now.
We felt guilty because we didn't pray hard enough.
Oh, I see.
You know, somehow I just didn't care. You know, I'm talking about the whole congregation as a whole, not as individuals.
Did you want to
have a young family?
Yeah, I just want to make the comment that in Shadowlands, and I haven't read the book, but I saw the movie not too long ago, C.S. Lewis's story. Mm-hmm. As his wife died, his friends asked, you know, you prayed through all this to change things, and yet she still died.
Yeah.
What's happened to your faith? He said, I didn't pray to change things. I prayed that God would change me. Mm-hmm. And he said, in that sense, his prayer had been answered in a way that was satisfactory.
Yeah, that's where it's at. We're not doing that in our congregation.
We had a situation like that in our congregation, lost a very great leader, tremendous person with cancer, but the funeral service was a matter of celebration. And I have watched the memorial services change through the years. They're a celebration of life. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the kind of thing that can be built up in a congregation, a celebration of the life that has been lived.
Mm-hmm. Eucharist at funeral memorial service.
I'm aware of the time.
The congregation ready to get into the left side of the brain.
I'm officially going to end the conversation. I just want to thank you all very much for coming. Thank our resource people and, you know, the courage and the good listening and the speaking. Please let it continue. So, good night.